God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. And without further ado, Tim.
Thank you. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Tim.
Hi, Tim.
We're in the fourth week of the series here, and we're on Chapter 2, There is a Solution. So far we covered the preface and the forewords the first week, and then we did the doctor's opinion the week after that, and Bill's story last week. And it's interesting to note the things that go on in my life that seem to coincide with this whole process. I told you a story last Monday about for the first time I was actually told how to speak when I went to a particular meeting, and that followed up with was at another meeting Thursday night where it became all about that particular topic. And it's important for me to point out that I come to Alcoholics Anonymous specifically for my alcoholism. I don't come here for any other ailment that I have. I don't come here for any sort of mood disorder. I don't come here, if I broke my leg, I certainly wouldn't come to an AA meeting. I'd go to the doctor. You know, and to that end, it's important for me to put that out there. Because I used to do that. I used to come to AA for a one-size-fits-all program, and it didn't work, and it nearly killed me. So I find that it's very important for me personally to let people know that if you have other things that are bothering you, that you should seek the appropriate help. You know, in here, I feel that, you know, if you want help with your alcoholism, this is absolutely the right place to come. But for other issues, you should seek other avenues. And perhaps, I know from my experience was that I did find other people within the rooms that knew those avenues and said, oh, here's where I went, and here's what I do. And it was offline, and it was in a manner of one-to-one sort of thing. It didn't become a topic of a meeting, you know. And so it's interesting to note that. So once again, what I like to say is my disclaimer that this is my experience, strength, and hope with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I in no way speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, but like I said, always say at times I will sound like I do. And so that's still one of those character defects that's still cruising around. What I like to do is I like to read the book and go through it and talk about, you know, the experience of that in my life, my experience with other people with that. And it's basically, on a group level, what I would normally do one-on-one with somebody sitting across from me. And once again, Tim's opinion states that if you're working with a sponsor and you don't have a big book between you, you should get a different sponsor. That's my opinion, because this is the program here. So, Chapter 2, There is a Solution, starts on page 17 in my book. I'm pretty sure that still remained. And it says here, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. So right there in the first paragraph of the chapter, it tells us exactly what recovered meant. That they solved their drink problem. Doesn't mean that they can go back to drinking. It's just that the problem of drinking has been solved. Now, in the first edition, I checked that because I recalled that it was different. Nearly wasn't there originally because it was presented as all have recovered. Because at the time it was. You know, obviously since then we've had many more than 100 people. So, moving on. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. Now, at the time Alcoholics Anonymous started back in the 30s, most of the alcoholics that he was referring to there were people who were professionals who had lost their standing through their alcoholism. And it's ironic because I think that particular sentence, we are people who normally would not mix, was incredibly prophetic. I mean, because I know, you know, I could just look around this room, and I could definitely say we are people who normally would not mix. And, you know, and that was certainly true when I came in. Again, I came in when I was young, so I sat in a room full of quote-unquote old people, and I definitely wouldn't mix with them, that's for sure. But they certainly saved my life by presenting this. And then he's going to describe that feeling of what we have. We are like the passengers of a great liner after the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Isn't that just a beautiful picture? We all get along. It's wonderful, right? And then this I always like this. It's so early in the book, page 17, and here we already says, unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. And that's pretty much stating that, okay, yeah, well, we're all alcoholics, and we've all recovered, but there's more than that. You know, so to me, that once again, that you know, that misnomer of don't drink and go to meetings that flies around the room all the time, right there is said, that's not going to work. Okay, yeah, we don't drink, and obviously that's what we all do if we're recovered alcoholics or if we're in recovery, we don't drink. But just the fellowship of going to meetings and getting together isn't enough. And he states it. And then this is wonderful. I wish this were still true today. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. There's a lot of common solutions around nowadays, I think. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. Again, I wish that's how it were. I mean, there's so much contention about, this book was written in 1938, and it doesn't apply today, it's the 21st century, and so far through our travels through the book, I know for me it's been quite evident that it still applies today. It's quite true in my life and in other people's lives that I've talked to and experienced that with. And just brotherly and harmonious action. I wish there was more brotherly and harmonious action. There just seems to be a constant, don't listen to that guy. He's one of those big book thumpers. Or even more disparaging, he's one of those big book Nazis, which I always think is, well, did you ever study Nazis? I mean, they were trying to kill everybody. You know, people who usually carry around the big book want to try to save people. I mean, that's kind of a ridiculous thing. So I just think it comes out of fear. And then he states it because he stated it. It's just wonderful what he's going to say about this book. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Like, how cool is that? He says this is great news. It's great news. We have a common solution. Common solution. That anybody who has a problem with alcoholism, here you go. Just some great news. We got sober. We recovered. We wrote it down, and we're going to pass it on to you. That's pretty cool. It wasn't a theory. I mean, it worked, you know, so they were nice. Now, 18, it says, an illness of this sort, and we come to believe it as an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. Now, if we recall, like, the doctor's opinion and the illness that was described, and in Bill's story, that obsession of the mind and the compulsion of the body, you know, obsessing about drinking, compulsion because we have that manifestation of an allergy and we have an allergic reaction to the alcohol, and that cycle just happening, you know, and because of it, it has that effect on, certainly on me, that once I put the alcohol in me, it changes my personality, it changes who I am, and it definitely affects everybody in my life. Whether I've known them for a time or I just met them. And that's certainly apparent in my experiences. And once again, Bill was very careful not to label alcoholism as anything that could be contentious. Like, he didn't call it a disease. Nowhere does he say that alcoholism is a disease. That's outside issues. And but he does know, based on the description given to him by Silkworth, given to him by his own experience and others, that it's certainly an illness at the very least. A cold is an illness, and it's something that we can overcome, and we can manage our lives and stay fairly healthy as the result of it. So, and then he talks about exactly why. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all those lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. And I'm sure for each individual in this room, there may be things that are on that list or that apply, and that there's other things that they can certainly add to the list. I know for me, there were certainly ones that I could add. But I always find that interesting. Like, here it is, that's written in 1938, and here's this presentation of stigma and attitude towards alcoholism, this illness, and it's specific about it. A person has cancer, and nobody yells at people who have cancer. What's the matter with you? Get out of that bed. So what? You have cancer. Everybody's got cancer. That never goes on. But for some reason, alcoholics, it becomes like, oh, you're an alcoholic and you don't know how to control yourself and you're a bum and you're spending all this money, and it always becomes this thing. Nobody yells at people with diabetes. Well, I don't know. I used to yell at my ex-wife. So. but that's because she wasn't managing her illness. So it really came down to the same type of thing. It came down to doing sneaky stuff because she was not allowed to have sugar. So her actions would be the same as an alcoholic who was not allowed to have alcohol, who would set up reasons for why the drink was operative. And she would do the same thing with sugar. She would purposefully not eat. She wouldn't eat dinner, or she wouldn't, just so she could have that piece of cake 3 hours from now, because she knew her blood sugar was going to be low. So it becomes this insidious thing. It's very powerful. And it's certainly something that I've experienced on a secondhand basis, that I'm happy that I'm just an alcoholic, because I don't have to do that anymore. I'm recovered from that. So, and then he says, and this is what I like here. It says, we hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are, or who may be affected. There are many. And for me, there is a solution, is the first chapter in which Alcoholics Anonymous presents hope to those who are suffering from alcoholism. It talked about it before already, the hopelessness feature of alcoholism. And without some sort of hope, why would anybody want to try what we're doing? Why would anybody be convinced, this way of life is better for you, so this is what you should do? I mean, I know for me, when I got sober, I needed hope. I was like, I was 21, and oh my God, what am I going to do? I have the rest of my life, and I can't drink. How am I going to do that? And unfortunately for me, there were people who had experienced the same type of thing. They got sober when they were young, and they were sober for years. So they gave me hope. They were a living, walking, talking, breathing example of, oh, really? You were just as bad as I was? Oh, you were worse, because then they started telling me stories. I was like, I never did that. And fortunately for me, I didn't have that thing, oh, maybe I better go out and try some more. But it definitely gave me that hope of oh, you got sober, you're living a better life, you're in school, you have money, you have a job, you have this going on. How did you do that? And he handed me this book. And I went, oh, okay, I get it. And this book certainly did give me hope. I remember reading it when I was first getting sober, and being filled with hope, being very excited about it, because the book described me. It told me why I did the things that I did, and it said, "Yeah, this is you," and because this was us. And it was really cool, and I just always got excited, and I've been fired up ever since. So, Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss the situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. Now, I certainly identify with that. Because, you know, I've told the story before. When I got sober, I was looking for a counselor, an alcohol and drug counselor, you know, because I didn't want to come here to you crazy AA people with God. And, you know, and I didn't want to talk to any counselor who wasn't an alcoholic. So the irony was, you know, you have to be an alcoholic counselor who was in recovery to be able to for me to talk to. And I didn't talk to them anyway. So, I mean, that's how crazy I was. So, and here we are with italics. Once again, expensive words. So it tells me that I need to pay attention to it. It says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And, one thing to mention that ex-problem drinker, it used to say ex-alcoholic, and once again I'll say that they changed that. Their reasoning for changing that was to coincide with the philosophy later on in the book of once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And my personal opinion is I wish they changed that, you know, because I don't feel that way. I don't feel that you're always going to be plagued by this. You know, I'm recovered, I'm free, I did the work. And so I don't worry about. I was at a show last night in the city, and with two people that I went to college with, and they're both standing there with glasses of wine, and one of them asked me, said, "This doesn't bother you?" I said, "Oh, I don't have a problem with that anymore." They're like, "Really? Just being around it?" I said, "That doesn't affect me. That's been removed. It's gone. You know, and that's as the result of this work." And so right there, it was another experience of God giving me that power. Because if it were up to me, I'd be like, "Yeah, can I have yours?" You know, that would have been, and get me another one while you're at it. You know, that's so ex-alcoholic, because that's, you know, like I've said before, in order to be an alcoholic, you have to be drinking alcoholically. You know, so for me, like, you know, just introducing myself as a recovered alcoholic is enough. I've toyed with the idea of saying ex-alcoholic, just to kind of light up a room, but that's controversial, you know. So, but and then he talks about, you know, like with this solution, meaning what's in this book and what he's presenting. Not like, okay, well, if you want to get sober, you know, you have to get involved in sobriety and you have to put chairs away. And when I got sober, there were still ashtrays, so it was the ABCs, as they called it, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. And I don't know if anybody else remembers, but they used to have coffee mug commitments, too, which I don't have mine this week. But you know, that's one of the reasons why I still carry a ceramic mug, because it was, you know, it reminds me of when I got sober. It was like people came around and you put your coffee mug on the trays and they washed it. And that was a commitment, you know. So a little throwback. But nevertheless, that was never something that was ever going to keep me sober. I've washed a lot of stuff in my life. You know what I mean? I've washed entire sinks full of dishes drunk. You know, and felt very proud of that. So I washed the dishes, you know. Get me a beer. So it was never, you know, that solution didn't work for my alcoholism. I needed this solution, this solution here. And armed with facts about myself. So I'm armed with my facts. And I like where it says, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And it's important to note that in a few hours. Because it takes a few hours. It's not like 15 minutes after a meeting when they have their meeting book. And, "Oh, you're coming back tomorrow? Oh, yeah, I got my book." And, you know, and they shuffle out the door. You know, we read it in Bill's story last week when Abby came to see him. And he says, he talked for hours. You know, I just love that. That's, you know, one of the things that's wonderful about the big book is it's so dynamic. That's when I've read that thing, those four words, I've read at least 1,000 times. And for some reason, when I read them last week here in this room, it's just like the words were huge to me. He talked for hours, you know. And to me, it takes that, because that was my experience. People talking for hours, sharing their stuff with their facts about themselves. And so they gained my confidence because I could trust them. Oh, He knows exactly what's going on. He gets it. Because I didn't trust anybody. I don't know if anybody else relates to that. When I got here, I didn't trust anybody. No one. I barely trust them now. But so I needed somebody that I could trust. And it was because he spent hours. It's because he was armed with the facts about himself. It's because he had this solution. And he won my confidence, you know. And that once that understanding was reached, a lot was accomplished. You know, and I've experienced that not accomplishing anything because that understanding isn't reached. You know, we go through that a lot. And it takes a lot of trying. I mean, Bill himself, you know, he got sober in December 34 and didn't meet Bob until May of 35. And the only person he was able to keep sober in that time was himself. So obviously, I mean, he didn't gain that confidence, and that there wasn't that understanding. And he talks about that. There were brief intervals with people who got sober, and then they got drunk again. You know, so it's amazing that I know for me, I love the gift of sobriety that I have. It's truly a gift to me. So, and then he goes on to describe. This is the first, I guess, description of the best way to approach somebody as a quote unquote a sponsor. How to sponsor people that approach. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty. That he obviously knows what he is talking about. That his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. That he has no attitude of holier than thou. Nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. That there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their bed and walk again. Now, for me, that was certainly the experience that I had. Unfortunately, there were a lot of lectures that I had to endure. And I, you know, if I have to be honest about it, I'm sure I do a lot of that myself. You know, because that's probably one of my character defects of, you know, oh, I get on this subject line and I want to tell you everything I know about it in case you die. You know? So I need to keep going and going and going. And I actually had an interesting experience. We went out to celebrate a guy that I sponsored, his anniversary. We went out to the diner. And we were sitting with a guy who had, I don't know, it was 8-9 days, something like that. And he's, you know, he's been in and out and constantly, he's a retread, as they say on the left coast. And he was asking questions, and he wanted to know about things, and specifically about this God thing, because he thought it was a bunch of crap. Right? So I'm telling him, sharing my stuff, this is my experience. Hey, did you feel like this? Yeah, I did too. And here's what happened. And at one point, at the end of the conversation, he says, he was obviously overwhelmed at this point. And he says, okay, stop talking at me. This conversation's over. And it really kind of took the whole table back, you know, and especially me, because I didn't think I was talking at him. You know, I thought I was answering questions and sharing the facts about myself enough. So, obviously, perception is a key element in how this message is carried. So, I don't know how he's doing. I have to follow up on that. But it's interesting. That was certainly a lesson right there, that after all this time, like, here I am. Oh, wait, I was talking at you? Oh. And then I cleared it. I was like, do you really feel that I was talking at you? Well, you know, and then he backpedaled, so I don't know, maybe I intimidated him on that. How dare you? Yeah. But, you know, and I find this, and I have a lot of respect for the people who I've seen throughout the years who have that approach. Unfortunately, there's that other side of things. There's the cult nature of AA, of you got to get a home group, you got to do 90-90, you got to get a coffee commitment, you got to go to a meeting every day, why aren't you calling your sponsor, you need to sit down, shut up, and there's all this stuff that goes. And I think, like, oh my God, no wonder we lose a lot of people, because who the hell wants to be told what to do all the time? Yeah, I mean, I know I was so used to that when I got here, and even since then. It's like, you know, most people, if they have a job, they usually have a boss, so their boss is telling them what to do. If they're married, they have a spouse, and the spouse is usually telling them what to do. You know, so then it becomes like, okay, I got my job, I got my spouse, I want to come here for me, and now these people are going to tell me what to do? Oh, come on, no way. You know, so I always, I try to be cognizant of that, and I watch for people who do that, and I always enjoy listening to those people. Okay, 19. None of us makes the sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. And right there, that's a direct opposite to your job now is to go to meetings. You know, that's all you have to worry about. Just AA is all you have to worry about. Well, obviously not. You know, the 12th step says practice these in all our affairs. I need to have other affairs. Okay. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Hey, look at that. I just said that. And for me, that's really the key. Like, I could be the most sober person on earth for an hour. I could talk spirit. I could weave a spiritual tapestry that the whole room would go, wow, he's really got it. But, like, come and see how I work. Come and see how my family reacts to me. And I always find that, too, you know, and especially for married people. For me, I was married in divorce and sobriety. And, you know, and I had, unfortunately, the attitude of, like, it was, screw your wife. You need to be an AA. And I thought, like, well, no. She's my wife. And but then I went the other way. And said, oh, no. You know, and the last story, now, I'll tell you an experience that I had. You know, I, like I said, I was young when I got sober, and I got married. I was 25 when I got married. So by the time I was almost 26, I was married almost a year, and I was having marital difficulties because, you know, marriage is tough. If you've never done it before, you don't know how to do it, you know, and... So I came to guys in the rooms who were married and who were sober longer than I had because I figured, well, they had a wealth of knowledge and experience. And I would go and I say, oh, well, she's doing this. And remember, I told you she was an unmanaged diabetic. And, you know, and that was always weighing on me. And, well, what about this and how should I do that? And, you know, and one of them said to me, well, why do you help her when she's sick? And I said, well, because if I don't, she's going to die. And then he said, well, maybe she needs to die. So I said, well, who do you think you're talking? I said, you want to step outside and talk about this? And at that point, that was like, for me, the final of... Because my experience in AA was that abusive experience of, oh, I spilled more than you drank, and all that garbage that I used to hear. The jealousy of older alcoholics having gotten sober older instead of younger and taking it out on me. Well, sorry. So that conversation, I said, you know what? I don't need this crap. And I left AA. Said, I don't need this. I'm recovered. I'm sober. I did this. And that at that point, I was sober what, 3.5 years at that point. So I really didn't need any more abuse. And that's what I was getting. I was getting abuse. I was coming to AA to get abused. And that to me, that was the complete opposite of this message that we're talking about here today. You know, there was no compassion, there was no understanding, there was no helpfulness there. There was, I'm going to feel better about myself at your expense. And I just felt like that's awful. And I still see this man today, and I don't speak with him, mm-hmm. And, you know, nor do I think he would probably remember, because it's my stuff, and that was, you know, 15, 16 years ago. So, in my home, there was no spirituality happening. There was no balance. I wasn't taking AA with me into my home life. I became that maniacal, self-centered, self-seeking alcoholic who wasn't drinking. You know, I don't believe in the dry drunk crap, you know, because if you're drunk, you can't be dry. So that's that. But I certainly wasn't treating my alcoholism. I wasn't working a spiritual solution that this book offers. So to me, I felt that was probably a big reason why it led to my divorce, because I wasn't the same person that I was when I got married. I was definitely angry and bitter and not working a program. So to me, it's that key, that balance. That's really important, that to be in AA and a part of AA and then taking that into my life and demonstrating that in what I do. So that's a really key there. All right, all of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. If we keep on the way we are going, there is little doubt that much good will result, but the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given us? Okay, so he says, quite blankly, many can recover if they have this solution. And he doesn't say, well, how then shall we present that which was so freely given us? I know. Let's start a new meeting. He doesn't say, get a coffee pot and we'll start a discussion meeting. He doesn't say that. He says, right here, we have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with, a drinking problem. So once again, it reiterates what I said at the beginning of the meeting. It's a program for anybody with a drinking problem. He doesn't say this is a program for people with grave emotional and mental disorders. He doesn't say this is a program for people who have a gambling problem. Although this has worked for us, so other people have said, hey, do you mind if we use that and see if it works for us? And they said, sure. But it's specific. Drinking problem. Because that's what I'm recovered from, a drinking problem. My thinking is still, suspect on most days. But I can still, the drinking problem is gone. Gone, right? Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book that would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. I don't know. I know my personality, and based on everything I've read about Bill Wilson, I'm not too sure if he was telling the truth when he wrote that thing about nothing would please us so much as to write a book that would contain no basis for contention or argument. that's just that. So, most of us sense that a real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Oh, God, if that were only true. I so many times I sit in meetings and I hear the bashing of doctors, the bashing of therapists, the bashing of psychiatrists, the bashing of priests, rabbis. Oh, my God. How is that a real tolerance? They don't know. Only we know. Those doctors can't help you. Only we can help you. And it just becomes the same thing that we were getting. Well, I know my experience was that singularity of, this is the only way. It's the only way. Don't question. This is the only way. So I just wish that there was that going on. All right, and this is one of my absolutely favorite lines in the book. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers, in the first edition, ex-alcoholics, depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. I mean, that's a point-blank declaration. If I'm thinking about me, my life is in danger. I need to... Constant. It says constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. And because I'm in their... It says here, an ex-problem drinker. Because of who I am, the nature of who I am. Because I'm selfish. We'll see later on that's the root of my problem. I'm selfish. So... here we are on page 20, and once again, as it's stated in the doctor's opinion, Bill and everyone else that had a hand in the editing of this book says, hey, this is not a selfish program. This is about helping other people, because my life depends on helping other people. My life depends on helping other people. Okay, my life depends on helping other people. It doesn't say, it may be a good thing. It'll be enhanced. It will be a much better life. It will get better. It says my life depends on it. So so I need to heed that. I need to heed that. And that has proven true for me on many occasions. So, you may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless, you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Okay, what do I have to do? And naturally, the answer is, don't drink and go to meetings. No, it's definitely not that answer. Or it'd be written here. That's I don't know. And I always say this, if it were as simple as don't drink and go to meetings, wouldn't we just print up an 8.5 by 11 flyer that says don't drink and go to meetings and stop printing this book? If it were that easy? Here, just don't drink, go to meetings. But it'd be the little flyer group, I don't know. And there's that, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Hopeless condition of mind and body. My obsessive, compulsive nature, my obsession for drinking, my compulsion to pick up the drink, the manifestation of the allergy, that phenomenon of craving, I've recovered from that. Recovered from it. And if you want to do that, what do I have to do? If you're an alcoholic who wants to have that, what do I have to do? And then he says, well, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Not in a general way, specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. And I remember my first sponsor, he always said that, Tim, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do. And I went, oh, okay, that makes sense. And there it is. Right? We shall tell you, before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He can stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. People who don't have the phenomenon of craving. People who don't, you know, take that one drink and all bets are off. People who can take it or leave it. People who can stop for whatever reason, right? So now he's going to give a description of that. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. I don't understand those people at all. I never have. Never have. Hey, you want a drink? Nah. What do you mean, nah? It's a drinking party. I'll have an iced tea. What? There's two kegs. Iced tea. I couldn't get them. I never got them. People, I know there are people in this room who have experienced that person you go out to dinner with a glass of wine, and that they leave half of it. Oh, God. Who are you? Half. That's a $10 glass of wine. You better drink that, you know. So, and he says, then there's a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. Now, in that list, we could also say, going to jail, the threat of going to jail, losing your license, the threat of losing your job, all these wonderful things that I've heard for years and years and years and years and years in these rooms. And people who have even had to have gone and needed medical attention because they were at a level at that particular point that their body needed to be detoxified. So they needed to go and be detoxed. And it talks about, I still don't really get that. You know, I heard, when people say things like, I was a functioning alcoholic, I've never known a functioning alcoholic. I've known plenty of functioning hard drinkers. This is my opinion. This is what I've seen. Hard drinkers. People, it impairs them mentally and physically. They may die a few years before their time. But they literally, they're not, I mean, they could get drunk. They may not get drunk. They may have like 4 or 5 drinks a day. and yet still function and do their entire life. I don't get it. I don't understand how that's possible. Because when I was drinking and I was in my illness, there was no functioning. There were periods of functioning between not functioning. I needed alcohol to function. Though I didn't know it at the time, I just thought, what's a beer in the shower? You know, it's hot, I'm shaving, it's beer, it's the summertime, get dressed. Whatever. Like, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing, that I was holding myself over until I could really drink the way I needed to and wanted to. I never understood that, right? So I'm wary about that sometimes here. And then he's just going to hit us in between the eyes. Now, but what about the real alcoholic? The real one. The real alcoholic, right? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And my friend Chris here, he loves to talk about that, crossing the line. And there it is, crossing that line. Losing all control, and then there's the condition. Once he starts to drink. You know, there were plenty of times that I could control my drinking if I didn't drink. Like, if there's one beer in the refrigerator, I wasn't going to have that beer because that would just make me thirsty. There wasn't two. I needed six. So I'd go and get the six-pack, and now I had seven. So that was better than six. You know, so it became that thing of, like, once I started drinking, I lost all control. And maybe I could control it for an hour, maybe an hour or two, maybe up to that third drink, but forget it. Then I was, I have this, he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, and I have that underlined in my book, and it says, wow, next to it. Wow. Because to me, I was like, well, wait a minute. He could start off as a moderate drinker, and he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. And that just hit me. I was like, wow, you could go from a moderate drinker right to an alcoholic. I just never realized that. Oh, wow, you can do that. Because to me, it was that progression. It was, hey, yeah, I love this feeling. Oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be good. Why can't I stop? And what's going on? You know, so that was amazing to me. And then he's really going to get into it. He says, here's a fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. I certainly did. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldomly mildly intoxicated. I don't understand that either. He's always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly, even dangerously, antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated that he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospital and sanitariums. Interesting, like, you know, those drugs were legal back then and readily available. They were legal and alcohol was illegal. The irony. Now, that bottom line, here's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he always flip the clock around. That was certainly me. I definitely identified with that because that was a lot of times the goal. The goal was to get, you know, to pass out. To drink enough to pass out. And then I realized that I needed to get my 8-pack of Nips to go with me. So that way when I woke up, when I came to, I had a few drinks so I could go back. So I could pass out again. You know, and didn't realize that until after I got sober. Because, I'm a young guy. Yeah, well, it didn't matter how young I was. That was how that worked. And then he says, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. Now, that's kind of like a toss back to the doctor's opinion, where Silverth describes the five different categories. You know, my experience has been very difficult to when I speak with women who are coming into the program and who are questioning whether they're alcoholics. And it's most difficult for me to help them come to that conclusion. Because there's a lot of secretive, controlled drinking that goes on in between the periods of debauchery. You know, well, the last time I drank, I only had 3 glasses of wine. And it's like, okay, well, did you want a 4th? Well, yeah. Okay, and how soon after that 3rd glass of wine did you get in your car and drive? Well, like 5 minutes. Okay, so you were drunk and driving. Oh, I wasn't drunk. Oh, what do you mean you weren't drunk? You mean you were able to drive the car with no problem and say, oh, yeah, I was driving perfectly fine. And you had 3 glasses of wine in how long? Oh, like 1.5 hours. It's like, okay, so do you understand that you have a level of tolerance happening? That amount of wine is not doing anything to put you in a place where you will be perceivably not able to drive your car. Oh, well, yeah, no, well, I, yeah, oh, no, you know, and there's a lot of that goes on. Because technically they're drunk. You know, according to the law and their blood alcohol content, they're drunk, bless you, when they get behind that wheel of the car. But yet here they are operating a deathmobile under the influence of alcohol, because they're not alcoholics. Okay, so that's a difficult thing. I put that out there because I want people to understand that that still goes on. In the 21st century, that trying to convince somebody, you know, because there's that whole thing, we can't tell anybody we're alcoholic, they're alcoholics. Yes, we can. Doesn't say that anywhere. It says we don't like to. But we can, and will, and do, and they did also. Because it says that in the story section. They told people, you're an alcoholic. You're a drunk. No, I'm not. How dare you? Well, how dare you? So, I mean, like, it's important to put that there. So, why does he behave like this? Okay. If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant sufferings and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of his common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer this riddle. You know, and it talks about that. That's the, you know, that once we cross that line, once we become pickles, little can be, we can't be cucumbers anymore. And, you know, I find it interesting that he says, perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Because obviously, in all this time, there really isn't one. But the opinions are there. You know, why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people, there's that the physical aspect of alcoholism, that our bodies and our minds are physiologically different, and it only occurs in this type of drinker and not in the normal temperate drinker. And that's what we have in our book that tells us that. I need to say, I find this interesting that so far of all the critics of AA, because I read all of that stuff, because I want to know what their argument is. I want to know what they actually have a problem with AA. Right? And all the people that I read their stuff, and I'm certainly not going to tell you their name because I'm not promoting them, but of all of them, none of them are MDs. Not one of them that I've read has MD after their name. A lot of PhDs, a lot of, you know, master's people, but nobody was, not one medical doctor have I ever seen write a book against AA. I always find that interesting. Well, why is that? So, a little food for thought, right? All right, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. Well, I know that for a fact. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Well, I am one, and I can certainly say that that was. That's how it worked for me. I don't know about anybody else, but it certainly worked for me that way. Okay, now he said, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, rather than in his body. Because really, I mean, you don't drink, there's no craving. There's no craving anymore. You know, oh, I'm craving a drink. And they say, oh, well, how long haven't you had a drink? Oh, 2 years. You're not craving anything. You're obsessing about something. That craving, in our case, for alcoholics, is that physical thing that happens when we put it in our body. So that coincides with what they're talking about. It centers in the mind. We're obsessing about the drink. Oh, that's the problem. Not the drink. Drink's just a symptom, right? Okay, if you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will often give you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc of an alcoholic's drink that an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. Now I always thought, like, wow, that's kind of strange that they have a certain plausibility. And then I thought about, oh, yeah, like, a child dying, my mother died, my father died, my spouse died. Yeah, there's a certain plausibility to that. Absolutely. The grief and, oh, I can't deal with this. Right. But then he talks about the ludicrous thing here. He says, they sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. It's amazing. Like, I experienced that in my own life. I experienced that with people that I work with, as far as going through this process and they're in that insanity of their life. You know, I still get there. I get in that insanity of my life, and I'm doing this and doing that and doing this and doing that. Oh, I can't say. And then somebody will draw my attention to my fallacious reasoning, that it's all screwed up, and I'll go, oh, no, it's really, it's not that. No, it's not that. So I'll go, what are you talking about? Well, I'm not doing that, you know, and I don't, you know, it gets reduced, I think. I don't think it ever goes away, but it certainly gets reduced. And I know for me, like, you know, I sit in meetings and I hear people talk and they share their experience, strength, and hope, and they're in a particular place in their recovery, and you can hear that in their share. And, you know, my one of my sponsors, we used to say, oh, that was a very time-appropriate share based on where they are in their recovery. Like, if they're at 5 years, there's a certain way that people share for some reason when they're at 5 years. And, like, and you go up to them, you can kind of, like, you know, guess on that. You know, oh, how long are you sober? About 5 years? And they're like, yeah, you know that. And I go, oh, we know. You know? And I'm sure that people who are beyond where I'm at in their time and their years in recovery probably say the same thing about me. But, that's because he only has 19 years, you know. Right? And because I know it sounds goofy, but, you know, that I'm sure, because I think about that. I think about people who are sober, like, 30 years, 40 years, 45, 50 years. Like, and they must, I can't imagine what they must think sitting in these rooms. I've asked them, and some of them say, oh, I really don't hear anything. You know, I'm just here to show that it works. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, because it does. That's certainly. Well, how long have you been sober? 50 years. And how'd you do that? What that book says. Huh. Must work. So, I'm grateful that they're always there, because that certainly gives me hope, right? Okay, so once in a while, he may tell the truth. Now, if we recall, like Dr. Silkworth said, that, you know, their alcoholic life is the only one they know. They cannot differentiate the true from the false. So once again, that's a throwback there. And truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. And there it is, right? Okay, there's the obsession, that obsessive mind. Oh, it'll be different this time. It'll be, oh, I can do it, it'll be different. Once the malady has a real hold, what malady? The spiritual malady that creates that obsession. Once it has a real hold, we're baffled. I know I was. I definitely was. Down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. But everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Bite the bullet. Get off your butt. All that crap, right? The tragic truth is, if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. He has lost control. Right? Four words. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, doesn't say most, it says every, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. Excuse me. Now, it's amazing. There it is that our only requirement for membership, the desire to stop drinking, is of absolutely no avail to stop us from drinking. Amazing, right? So, obviously, there must be more to it. And then he says, in italics, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And that's pretty much saying that it doesn't matter if you think the drink through, because there are going to be certain times when thinking the drink through is not going, it will be of no avail to you. That you have to have, there's no defense against that. Thinking the drink through, there's mental blank spots, that it just becomes like, or maybe you think the drink through and yes, that's exactly what I want. Right? So, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is the complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sakes, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have that thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink, or what's the use anyhow?" Right? Then he says, it was wonderful, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. Right? Now, thinking. That sort of thinking. Thinking. Not actions, not behavior. Thinking. When the thinking is fully there, beyond human aid. So I can't change my thinking all by myself. That's what it's telling me. I need something else. And unless I'm locked up, you know, I may die or go nuts. Well, you know, I haven't died yet. I know what it's like to go nuts. And that's what I did, right? These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. By the way, a legion, a Roman legion, was between 3,000 and 6,000 men. I looked it up for you. Right? But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. Now it says right there, but for the grace of God. It doesn't say, but for the grace of meetings. It doesn't say, you know, they have a lot of meetings in the bank. It doesn't say, well, they're in AA. It says, but for the grace of God. Right? And then here's the biggest hope. There is a solution. Okay, what's the solution? Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. Requires. In order for it to be successful and for me to have permanent recovery, I have to do these things. I have to, right? But we saw that it really worked in others. And we come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. When, therefore, we were approached in those whom the problem had been solved, recovered, there was nothing for us left but to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we had not even dreamed. Now, in how it works, we hear this all the time. If you want what we have, and to me, this is what we have. Because it says here, the great fact is this and nothing less. So that's pretty cool. This is a great fact, and this is our minimum. This is our minimum. We could get better than this, but this is our minimum. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do by ourselves. Wow. So when we say, if you want what we have, I'm not willing to go to any length to it, bless you. If we present that to people, do you want that? Because I know I wanted that, and I have that. That's a great fact for me. I've had that great fact. It's been accomplished. That's the central fact in my life today. I'm absolutely certain that my higher power lives in my heart and does for me things, miraculous things, things that I couldn't do for myself. I couldn't stop drinking myself. I talk about it all the time. Without God, I'm going to drink. That's where God lives, in my heart. It's absolute certainty. And that's deep and effective. And it's a spiritual experience. It revolutionized. It overthrew my old way of thinking, my old way of doing things, and replaced it with a brand new one. Fresh. Wonderful. And that's a great fact for me. And then he challenges the reader. Here it is. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. So if you're suffering from an obsession of the mind and a compulsion of the body, and you have a physical allergy that and a manifestation of the phenomenon of craving, if you're that, there's no middle-of-the-road solution. That's it. He says, here it is. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. Not drinking, life. And if we pass into the region from which there is no return through human aid, so no self-will, no human power, right? We have but two alternatives, and there's my colon, my favorite colon, right? One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation best we could. And the other, four simple words, to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to, and were willing to make the effort. That's going to tell a story of Roland Hazard. This is Roland Hazard. This is the man who came and vouched for Ebby and passed the message on to him, which passed the message on to Bill, and so on and so on. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years he had flourished, floundered from one sanitarium to the other, had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Young, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. The doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. This was a great physician's opinion. And bodyguards don't work. John Belushi hired two of them so he wouldn't do drugs, and he beat them both up, put them in the hospital, and went and got high. So that didn't work. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. So basically he's saying, well, no, you can't. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to such cases as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experience, vital, necessary for life. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I have been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Wow. Right? Wow. There's hope for you. So, for me, like, you know, we talked about what it is that we have, and that's what I have. So I understand exactly what he's saying there. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding forces of my life have been replaced with completely new ones and work, right? And I'm an alcoholic in his description. Obsessive mind, compulsive body, manifestation of an allergy, phenomenon of craving. That's me, right? Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they do not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience necessary for life. Right? Here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proven to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book, Varieties of Religious Experiences, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. Now, that, you know, Bill Wilson was really brilliant because I've tried to read that book, and that's a difficult read, man. That's tough. And he read it and understood it. I just, whew, wow. We have no desire to convince anyone that there's only one way by which faith can be acquired. That's really important. We say that all, you know, I hear people, oh, this is the only way. No, it's not. If we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understanding terms as soon as we're willing and honest enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There's no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours. What religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. It's no concern of mine, that's for sure. This should be an entirely personal affair, which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. In the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism, as we understand it. Then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who were once in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find no such convictions. We find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Now, he gives us a wonderful hint here. He says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 43 personal experiences. In the fourth edition, it's 42. Each individual, now this is really important here. He says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. So it doesn't say that how they stopped drinking. It's just how they established their relationship with God. Right? We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. So, it's really important that, you know, the stories are a part of the program. I hear it all the time. Oh, the first 164. No, we just read that the stories are about how to establish a relationship with God. So we can't ignore them. You know, that's why we speak. That's why we go out on speaking commitments and share our experience, strength, and hope. So that way we can find out what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, our relationship with God. You know, so to me, that chapter is chock full of hope. Wonderful stuff. And it sets us up for next week to get into actually starting the step process. Well, you know, 29 pages to cover all of that, and we didn't get to step one yet, I think. So it's pretty important that we establish that, you know, what we are and where we're coming from. So that's it for tonight. So I hope I helped somebody. Thanks. All right.